The Celestine Prophecy, Cassette 4.
The two priests nodded politely as I entered the house. A roaring fire fended off the evening chill, and several oil lamps illuminated the front room. The air was filled with the smell of vegetable or perhaps potato soup. On the table was a ceramic bowl, several spoons, and a plate holding four slices of bread. One of the priests turned and left without looking at me, and the other kept his eyes lowered and nodded at a large cast-iron pot sitting on the hearth by the fire. A handle protruded from under its lid. As soon as I saw the pot, the second priest asked, "Is there anything else you need?" "I think not," I said. "Thank you." He nodded and left the house as well, leaving me alone. I lifted the lid from the pot. Potato soup. It smelled rich and delicious. I poured several ladles full into a bowl and sat down at the table, then pulled the part of the manuscript Sanchez had given me from my pocket and placed it beside my plate, intending to read. But the soup tasted so good that I focused entirely on eating. After I finished, I placed the dishes in a large pan and stared at the fire, hypnotized, until the flames burned low. Then I turned down the lamps and went to bed. The next morning I was awakened at dawn feeling totally refreshed. Outside, a morning mist rolled through the courtyard. I stoked up the fire and put several pieces of kindling on the coals and fanned it until it caught up. I was about to look through the kitchen for food when I heard Sanchez's truck approaching. I walked outside as he emerged from behind the church, a backpack in one arm and several packages in the other. "I have some news," he said, motioning me to follow him back inside the house. Several other priests appeared with hot corn cakes and grits and more dried fruit. Sanchez greeted the men, then sat with me at the table as the priests scurried away. "I attended a meeting of some of the priests in the Southern Council," he said. "We were there to talk about the manuscript. At issue was the government's aggressive actions. This was the first time any group of priests has met publicly in support of this document, and we were just beginning our discussion when a government representative knocked on the door and asked to be admitted." He paused as he served his plate and took several bites, chewing them thoroughly. "The representative," he continued, "assured us that the government's sole purpose was to protect the manuscript from outside exploitation. He informed us that all copies being held by Peruvian citizens must be licensed. He said he understood our concern, but asked us to comply with this law and turn in our copies. He promised that government duplicates would be issued back to us at once." "Did you turn them in?" I asked. "Of course not." We both ate for a few minutes. I tried to overchew, to appreciate the taste. "We asked about the violence in Cula," he went on, "and he told us that this was a necessary reaction against a man called Jensen, that several of his men were armed agents from another country. He said they planned to find and steal the undiscovered part of the manuscript and remove it from Peru, so the government had no choice but to arrest them. There was no mention of you or your friends." "Did you believe the government man?" "No, we didn't." After he left, we continued the meeting. We agreed that our policy would be one of quiet resistance. We will continue to make copies and distribute them carefully. "Will your church leaders allow you to do that?" I asked. "We don't know," Sanchez said. "The church elders have disapproved of the manuscript, but so far have not seriously investigated who is involved with it. Our main concern is a cardinal who resides farther north, Cardinal Sebastian. He is the most vocal in opposition to the manuscript and is very influential. If he convinces the leadership to issue strong proclamations, then we will have a very interesting decision to make." "Why is he so opposed to the manuscript?" "He is afraid."
"Why?"
"I haven't spoken with him in a long time, and we always avoid the subject of the manuscript. But I believe he thinks man's role is to participate in the cosmos ignorant of spiritual knowledge, by faith alone. He thinks the manuscript will undermine the status quo, the lines of authority in the world."
"How would it do that?"
He smiled and tilted his head back slightly. The truth shall set you free. I was looking at him, trying to understand what he meant, eating the last of the bread and fruit on my plate. He ate several more tiny bites and pushed his chair back. You seem much stronger, he said. Did you talk with anyone here? Yes, I replied. I learned a method of connecting with the energy from one of the priests. I didn't catch his name. He was sitting in the area while we were talking in the courtyard yesterday morning, remember? When I spoke with him later, he showed me how to absorb energy and then to project it back. His name is John, Sanchez said, then nodded for me to go on. It was an amazing experience, I said. By remembering the love I felt, I was able to open up. I sat up there all day, simmering in it. I didn't reach the state I experienced on the ridge, but I got close. Sanchez looked more serious. The role of love has been misunderstood for a long time. Love is not something we should do to be good or to make the world a better place out of some abstract moral responsibility, or because we should give up our hedonism. Connecting with energy feels like excitement, then euphoria, and then love. Finding enough energy to maintain that state of love certainly helps the world, but it most directly helps us. It is the most hedonistic thing we can do. I agreed, then noticed he had moved his chair back several more feet and was looking at me intensely, his eyes unfocused. So what does my field look like? I asked. It is much larger, he said. I think you feel very good. I do. Good. That is what we do here. Tell me about that, I said. We train priests to go farther into the mountains and work with the Indians. It is a lonely job, and the priests must have great strength. All of the men here have been screened thoroughly, and all have one thing in common. Each has had one experience he calls mystical. I have been studying this kind of experience for many years, he continued, even before the manuscript was found, and I believe that when one has already encountered a mystical experience, getting back into this state and raising one's personal energy level comes much easier. Others can also connect, but it takes longer. A strong memory of the experience, as I think you learned, facilitates its recreation. After that, one slowly builds back. What does a person's energy field look like when this is happening? It grows outward and changes color slightly. What color? Normally from a dull white toward green and blue. But the most important thing is that it expands. For instance, during your mystical encounter on the ridgetop, your energy flashed outward into the whole universe. Essentially, you connected and drew energy from the entire cosmos, and in turn, your energy swelled to encompass everything, everywhere. Can you remember how that felt? Yeah, I said. I felt as though the entire universe was in my body and I was just the head, or perhaps more accurately, the eyes. Yes, he said. And at that moment your energy field and that of the universe were the same. The universe was your body. I had a strange memory during that time, I said. I seemed to remember how this larger body, this universe of mine, evolved. I was there. I saw the first stars formed from simple hydrogen, and then saw more complex matter evolve in successive generations of these suns. Only I didn't see matter. I saw matter as simple vibrations of energy that were evolving systematically into ever more complex higher states. Then, life began and evolved to a point where humans appeared. I stopped suddenly and he noticed my changed mood. What's wrong? He said. That's where the memory of evolution stopped, I explained, with humans. I felt as if the story continued, but I couldn't quite grasp it. The story does go on, he said. Humans are carrying forth the universe's evolution toward higher and higher vibrational complexity. How? I asked. He smiled, but didn't answer. Let's talk about this later. I really must check on a few things. I'll see you in an hour or so. I nodded. He picked up an apple and walked out. I wandered outside behind him, then remembered the copy of The Fifth Insight in the bedroom and retrieved it. Earlier I had been thinking of the forest where Sanchez had been sitting when I first met him. Even in my fatigue and panic, I had noticed that the place was extraordinarily beautiful. So I walked down the road toward the west until I came to the exact spot, then sat down there myself. Leaning back against a tree, I cleared my mind and spent several minutes looking around. The morning was bright and breezy, and I watched the wind as it whipped the branches above my head. The air felt refreshing as I took in several deep breaths. During a lull in the wind, I took out the manuscript and looked for the page where I had stopped reading. Before I could locate it, however, I heard the sound of a truck engine. I lay flat beside the tree and attempted to determine its direction. The sound was coming from the mission. As it grew closer, I could see it was Sanchez's old truck, with him driving. "I thought you might be here," he said, as he pulled up to where I was standing. "Get in. We need to leave." "What's going on?" I asked, sliding into the passenger seat. We drove on toward the main road. "One of my priests told me of a conversation he overheard in the village. Some government officials are in town, and they were asking questions about me and the mission." "What do you think they want?" He looked at me reassuringly. "I don't know. Let's just say I'm not as certain as before that they will leave us alone. I thought as a precaution that we should drive up into the mountains. One of my priests lives near Machu Picchu. His name is Father Carl. We'll be safe at his house until we can better read the situation." He smiled. "I want you to see Machu Picchu anyway." I suddenly had a flash of suspicion that he had made a deal and was taking me somewhere to turn me in. I decided to proceed cautiously and to stay alert until I found out for sure. "Did you finish the translation?" he asked. "Most of it," I said. "You had asked about human evolution. Did you finish that part?" "No." He turned his eyes from the road and looked at me intensely. I pretended not to notice. "Is something wrong?" he asked. "Nothing," I said. "How long will it take to get to Machu Picchu?" "About 4 hours." I wanted to remain silent and let Sanchez talk, hoping he might give himself away, but I couldn't control my curiosity about evolution. "So how do humans further evolution?" I asked. He glanced at me. "What do you think?" "I don't know," I said. "But when I was up on the ridge, I thought it might have something to do with the meaningful coincidences that The First Insight talks about."
"That's right," he said. "That would fit with the other insights, wouldn't it?"
I was confused. I almost understood, but I couldn't quite grasp it. I remained silent.
"Think of how the insights fall into sequence," he said. "The first insight occurs when we take the coincidences seriously. These coincidences make us feel there is something more, something spiritual operating underneath everything we do. The second insight institutes our awareness as something real. We can see that we have been preoccupied with material survival, with focusing on controlling our situation in the universe for security. And we know our openness now represents a kind of waking up to what is really going on. The third insight begins a new view of life. It defines the physical universe as one of pure energy, an energy that somehow responds to how we think. And the fourth exposes the human tendency to steal energy from other humans by controlling them, taking over their minds. A crime in which we engage because we so often feel depleted of energy and cut off. This shortage of energy can be remedied, of course, when we connect with a higher source. The universe can provide all we need if we can only open up to it. That is the revelation of the fifth insight." "In your case," he continued, "you had a mystical experience that allowed you to briefly see the magnitude of energy one can acquire. But this state is like leaping ahead of everyone else and glimpsing the future. We can't maintain it for long. Once we try to talk to someone who is operating in normal consciousness, or try to live in a world where conflict is still happening, we get knocked out of this advanced state and fall back to the level of our old selves. And then, he continued, it is a matter of slowly regaining what we glimpsed, a little at a time, and to begin a progression back toward the ultimate consciousness. But to do this, we must learn to consciously fill up with energy, because this energy brings on the coincidences, and the coincidences help us actualize the new level on a permanent basis. I must have looked puzzled because he said, think about it. When something occurs beyond chance to lead us forward in our lives, then we become more actualized people. We feel as though we are attaining what destiny is leading us to become. When this occurs, the level of energy that brought on the coincidences in the first place is instituted in us. We can be knocked out of it and lose energy when we are afraid, but this level serves as a new outer limit which can be regained quite easily. We have become a new person. We exist at a level of higher energy, at a level, get this, of higher vibration. Can you see the process now? We fill up, grow, fill up and grow again. That is how we as humans continue the evolution of the universe to a higher and higher vibration. He paused for a moment, then seemed to think of something he wanted to add. This evolution has been going on unconsciously throughout human history. That explains why civilization has progressed and why humans have grown larger, lived longer, and so forth. Now, however, we are making the whole process conscious. That is what the manuscript is telling us. That is what this movement toward worldwide spiritual consciousness is all about. I was listening intensely, totally fascinated with what Sanchez was telling me. So all we have to do is fill up with energy, as I learned to do with John, and the coincidences begin to happen more consistently. Well, yes, but that's not as easy as you think. Before we can connect with the energy on a permanent basis, there is one more hurdle we must pass. The next insight, the sixth, deals with this issue. What is it? He looked squarely at me. We must face up to our particular way of controlling others. Remember, the fourth insight reveals that humans have always felt short of energy and have sought to control each other to acquire the energy that flows between people. The fifth then shows us that an alternative source exists, but we can't really stay connected with this source until we come to grips with a particular method that we, as individuals, use in our controlling and stop doing it. Because whenever we fall back into this habit, we get disconnected from the source. Getting rid of this habit isn't easy because it's always unconscious at first. The key to letting it go is to bring it fully into consciousness. And we do that by seeing that our particular style of controlling others is one we learned in childhood to get attention, to get the energy moving our way, and we're stuck there. This style is something we repeat over and over again. I call it our unconscious control drama. I call it a drama because it is one familiar scene, like a scene in a movie, for which we write the script as youths. Then we repeat this scene over and over in our daily lives without being aware of it. All we know is that the same kind of events happen to us repeatedly. The problem is, if we are repeating one particular scene over and over, then the other scenes of our real-life movie, the high adventure marked by coincidences, can't go forward. We stop the movie when we repeat this one drama in order to manipulate for energy. Sanchez slowed the truck and moved carefully forward through a series of deep ruts in the road. I realized I was frustrated. I couldn't quite grasp how a control drama worked. I almost expressed my feelings to Sanchez, but I couldn't. I realized I still felt distant from him and didn't care to reveal myself. Did you understand? He asked. I don't know, I said curtly. I don't know if I have a control drama. He looked at me with the warmest regard and chuckled out loud. Is that so? He asked. Then why do you always act so aloof? Clearing the past. Ahead, the road narrowed and bent sharply around the sheer rock face of the mountain. The truck bounced over several large rocks and slowly proceeded through the curve. Below, the Andes rose in massive gray ridges above banks of snow-white clouds. I looked at Sanchez. He was leaning over the steering wheel, tense. For most of the day, we had been scaling steep inclines and edging through passages made more narrow by fallen rock. I had wanted to broach the subject of control dramas again, but the time seemed inappropriate. Sanchez appeared to need every ounce of energy for driving, and besides, I wasn't clear on what I wanted to ask. I had read the rest of the Fifth Insight, and it had echoed exactly the point Sanchez had related to me. The idea of getting rid of my style of controlling seemed desirable, especially if it would make my evolution accelerate, but I still couldn't grasp how a control drama operated. "What are you thinking about?" Sanchez asked. "I finished reading the Fifth Insight," I said, "and I was thinking about these dramas. Considering what you said about me, I assume you think my drama has something to do with being aloof." He didn't reply. He was staring up the road. 100 feet ahead, a large four-wheel drive vehicle blocked the way. A man and a woman stood on a rock precipice 50 feet from the vehicle. They returned our gaze. Sanchez stopped the truck and looked them over for an instant, then smiled. "I know the woman," he said. "That's Julia. It's all right. Let's talk with them." Both the man and woman were of dark complexion and appeared Peruvian. The woman was older, appearing to be about 50, while the man looked approximately 30. As we got out of the truck, the woman walked toward us. "Father Sanchez," she said as she approached. "How are you, Julia?" Sanchez replied. The two embraced, then Sanchez introduced me to Julia. Julia, in turn, introduced her companion, Rolando. Saying nothing else, Julia and Sanchez turned their backs on us and walked toward the overhang where Julia and Rolando had previously been standing. Rolando looked at me intensely, and I instinctively turned and walked in the direction of the other two people. Rolando followed, still looking at me as though he wanted something. Although his hair and features were young, his complexion was ruddy and red. For some reason, I felt anxious. Several times as we walked to the edge of the mountain, he looked as though he was going to speak, but each time I turned my eyes away and increased my pace. He remained silent. When we reached the precipice, I sat on a ledge to prevent him from sitting next to me. Julia and Sanchez were above me about 25 feet, sitting together on a large boulder. Rolando sat as close to me as possible. Although his constant stare bothered me, I was slightly curious about him at the same time. He caught me looking at him and asked, "Are you here for the manuscript?" I took a long time to answer. "I've heard of it." He looked perplexed. "Have you seen it?" "Some," I said. "Do you have something to do with it?" "I am interested," he said, "but I have not seen any copies yet." A period of silence followed. "Are you from the United States?" he asked. The question disturbed me, so I decided not to answer. Instead, I asked, "Does the manuscript have anything to do with the ruins at Machu Picchu?" "I don't think so," he replied, "except that it was written about the same time they were built." I remained silent, looking out at the incredible view of the Andes. Sooner or later, if I remained quiet, he would divulge what he and Julia were doing here and how it concerned the manuscript. We sat for 20 minutes with no conversation. Finally, Rolando stood and walked up to where the others were talking. I was perplexed as to what to do. I had avoided sitting with Sanchez and Julia because I had the distinct impression they wanted to talk alone. For perhaps another 30 minutes, I remained there, gazing out at the rocky peaks and straining to overhear the conversation above me. None of them paid me the slightest bit of attention. Finally, I decided to join them. But before I could move, the three of them stood and began walking toward Julia's vehicle. I cut across the rocks toward them. They have to go, Sanchez remarked as I approached.
I'm sorry we did not have time to talk, Julia said. I hope we see you again.
She was looking at me with the same warmth Sanchez often displayed. As I nodded, she cocked her head slightly and added,
In fact, I have a feeling we will see you soon.
As we strolled down the rocky path, I felt the need to say something in response, but I couldn't think. When we reached her vehicle, Julia only nodded slightly and said a quick goodbye. Both she and Rolando got in and Julia drove away toward the north, the way Sanchez and I had come. I felt puzzled by the entire experience. Once we were in our vehicle, Sanchez asked, Did Rolando fill you in on Will?
No, I said. Had they seen him?
Sanchez looked confused. Yes, they saw him at a village 40 miles east of here.
Did Will say anything about me?
Julia said Will mentioned being separated from you. She said Will talked mainly with Rolando. Didn't you tell Rolando who you were?
No, I didn't know if I could trust him.
Sanchez looked at me in total bewilderment. I told you it was fine to talk with him. I've known Julia for years. She owns a business in Lima. But since the discovery of the manuscript, she has been looking for the ninth insight. Julia would not be traveling with anyone untrustworthy. There was no danger. Now you missed what could have been important information. Sanchez looked at me with a serious expression. This is a perfect example of how a control drama interferes, he said. You were so aloof, you didn't allow an important coincidence to take place. I must have appeared defensive. It's all right, he said. Everyone plays a drama of one kind or another. At least now you understand how yours works.
I don't understand, I said. What exactly am I doing?
Your way of controlling people and situations, he explained. In order to get energy coming your way, is to create this drama in your mind during which you withdraw and look mysterious and secretive. You tell yourself that you're being cautious, but what you're really doing is hoping someone will be pulled into this drama and will try to figure out what's going on with you. When someone does, you remain vague, forcing them to struggle and dig and try to discern your true feelings. As they do so, they give you their full attention and that sends their energy to you. The longer you can keep them interested and mystified, the more energy you receive. Unfortunately, when you play aloof, your life tends to evolve very slowly because you're repeating this same scene over and over again. If you had opened up to Rolando, your life movie would have taken off in a new and meaningful direction. I felt myself becoming depressed. All this was just another example of what Will had pointed out when he saw me resisting giving information to Renault. It was true. I did tend to hide what I really thought. I looked out the window as we followed the road higher into the peaks. Sanchez concentrated again on avoiding the fatal drop-offs. When the road straightened, he looked over at me and said, The first step in this process of getting clear, for each of us, is to bring our particular control drama into full consciousness. Nothing can proceed until we really look at ourselves and discover what we are doing to manipulate for energy. This is what has just happened to you.
What is the next step? I asked.
Each of us must go back into our past, back into our early family life, and see how this habit was formed. Seeing its inception keeps our way of controlling in consciousness. Remember, most of our family members were operating in a drama themselves, trying to pull energy out of us as children. This is why we had to form a control drama in the first place. We had to have a strategy to win energy back. It is always in relation to our family members that we develop our particular dramas. However, once we recognize the energy dynamics in our families, we can go past these control strategies and see what was really happening.
What do you mean, really happening?
Each person must interpret his family experience from an evolutionary point of view, from a spiritual point of view, and discover who he really is. Once we do that, our control drama falls away and our real lives take off. So how do I begin? By first understanding how your drama was formed. Tell me about your father. He is a good man who is fun-loving and capable, but I hesitated, not wanting to sound ungrateful toward my father. But what? Sanchez asked. Well, I said, he was always critical. I could never do anything right. How did he criticize you? Sanchez asked. A picture of my father, young and strong, appeared in my mind. He asked questions, then found something wrong with the answers. And what happened to your energy? I guess I felt drained, so I tried to keep from telling him anything. You mean you got vague and distant, trying to say things in a way that would get his attention but not reveal enough to give him something to criticize. He was the interrogator, and you dodged around him with your aloofness. Yeah, I guess. But what is an interrogator? An interrogator is another kind of drama. People who use this means of gaining energy set up a drama of asking questions and probing into another person's world with the specific purpose of finding something wrong. Once they do, then they criticize this aspect of the other's life. If this strategy succeeds, then the person being criticized is pulled into the drama. They suddenly find themselves becoming self-conscious around the interrogator and paying attention to what the interrogator is doing and thinking about, so as not to do something wrong that the interrogator would notice. This psychic deference gives the interrogator the energy he desires. Think about the times you have been around someone like this. When you get caught up in this drama, don't you tend to act a certain way so that the person won't criticize you? He pulls you off your own path and drains your energy because you judge yourself by what he might be thinking. I remembered the feeling exactly, and the person that came to mind was Jensen. So my father was an interrogator, I asked. That's what it sounds like. For a moment I was lost in thought about my mother's drama. If my father was an interrogator, what was my mother? Sanchez asked me what I was thinking. I was wondering about my mother's control drama, I said. How many different kinds are there? Let me explain the classifications spoken of in the manuscript, Sanchez said. Everyone manipulates for energy, either aggressively, directly forcing people to pay attention to them, or passively, playing on people's sympathy or curiosity to gain attention. For instance, if someone threatens you, either verbally or physically, then you are forced, for fear of something bad happening to you, to pay attention to him, and so to give him energy. The person threatening you would be pulling you into the most aggressive kind of drama, what the sixth insight calls the intimidator. If, on the other hand, someone tells you all the horrible things that are already happening to them, implying perhaps that you are responsible, and that if you refuse to help, these horrible things are going to continue, then this person is seeking to control at the most passive level, with what the manuscript calls a poor me drama. Think about this one for a moment. Haven't you ever been around someone who makes you feel guilty when you're in their presence, even though you know there is no reason to feel this way? Yes. Well, it's because you have entered the drama world of a poor me. Everything they say and do puts you in a place where you have to defend against the idea that you're not doing enough for this person. That's why you feel guilty just being around them. I nodded. Everyone's drama can be examined, he continued, according to where it falls on this spectrum from aggressive to passive. If a person is subtle in their aggression, finding fault and slowly undermining your world in order to get your energy, then, as we saw in your father, this person would be an interrogator. Less passive than the poor me would be your aloofness drama. So the order of dramas goes this way: intimidator, interrogator, aloof, and poor me. Does that make sense? I guess. You think everyone falls somewhere among these styles, That's correct. Some people use more than one in different circumstances. But most of us have one dominant control drama that we tend to repeat, depending on which one worked well on the members of our early family. It suddenly dawned on me. My mother did exactly the same thing to me as my father. I looked at Sanchez. My mother. I know what she was. She was also an interrogator. So you had a double dose, Sanchez said. No wonder you're so aloof. But at least they weren't intimidating you. At least you never feared for your safety. What would have happened in that case? You would have become stuck in a poor me drama. Do you see how this works? If you are a child and someone is draining your energy by threatening you with bodily harm, then being aloof doesn't work. You can't get them to give you energy by playing coy. They don't give a damn what's going on inside you. They're coming on too strong. So you're forced to become more passive and to try the poor me approach, appealing to the mercy of the person, guilt-tripping them about the harm they are doing. If this doesn't work, then as a child you endure until you are big enough to explode against the violence and fight aggression with aggression. He paused. Like the child you told me about, the one in the Peruvian family that served you dinner. A person goes to whatever extreme necessary to get attention energy in their family. And after that, the strategy becomes their dominant way of controlling to get energy from everyone, the drama they constantly repeat. I understand the intimidator, I said, but how does the interrogator develop? What would you do if you were a child and your family members were either not there or ignored you because they were preoccupied with their careers or something? I don't know. Playing aloof would not get their attention. They wouldn't notice. Wouldn't you have to resort to probing and prying and finally finding something wrong in these aloof people in order to force attention and energy? This is what an interrogator does. I began to get the insight. Aloof people create interrogators. That's right. And interrogators make people aloof. And intimidators create the poor me approach. Or, if this fails, another intimidator. Exactly. That's how control dramas perpetuate themselves. But remember, there is a tendency to see these dramas in others, but to think that we ourselves are free from such devices. Each of us must transcend this illusion before we can go on. Almost all of us tend to be stuck, at least some of the time, in a drama. And we have to step back and look at ourselves long enough to discover what it is. I was silent for a moment. Finally, I looked at Sanchez again and asked, "Once we see our drama, what happens next?" Sanchez slowed the truck in order to look me in the eyes. "We are truly free to become more than the unconscious act we play. As I said before, we can find a higher meaning for our lives, a spiritual reason we were born to our particular families. We can begin to get clear about who we really are." "We're almost there," Sanchez said. The road was cresting between two peaks. As we passed the huge formation on our right, I saw a small house ahead. It backed up to another majestic pinnacle of rock. "His truck isn't here," Sanchez said. We parked and walked to the house. Sanchez opened the door and walked inside while I waited. I took in several breaths. The air was cool and very thin. Overhead, the sky was dark gray and thick with clouds. It looked as though it might rain. Sanchez walked back to the door. "No one is inside. He must be at the ruins." "Well, how do we get there?" He suddenly looked exhausted. "They're up ahead about a half mile," he said, handing me the keys to the truck. "Follow the road past the next ridge, and you'll see them down below. Take the truck. I want to stay here and meditate." "Okay, I will," I said, walking around to get in the vehicle. I drove forward into a little valley and then up the next ridge, anticipating the view. The sight did not disappoint me. As I crested the ridge, I saw the full splendor of the ruins at Machu Picchu, a temple complex of massive, carefully shaped rocks, weighing tons sitting atop each other on the mountain. Even in the dull, cloudy light, the beauty of the place was overwhelming.
This ends side one of cassette four. Please turn the cassette over and start side two at the same point.